Support comes from Fox Tucson Theater's Picture Palace series, a diverse mix of classic films, family movie events, music and movie nights featuring local musicians paired with a themed movie, and independent Mexican film screenings by Cinema Tucson. More information is at foxtucson.com.
Let's all go to the lobby, once invited movie audiences to take a break and refuel at the concession stand. Now, Arizona Spotlight producer and host Mark McLemore and film essayist Krista Scheel invite film fans to join them in the lobby. Stock up on recommendations and share some history and conversations about great films from across time and around the world. Author and professor Antari Ali Gault returns to share insights about the history of Black American film. And we are joined by author Anna Cooper, assistant professor at the University of Arizona School of Theater, Film, and Television. We talk about Cooper's book covering post-war Hollywood's adoption of European styles and stories. Mark and I are along for the informative ride, offering ideas about realism and artifice, how people learn behavior from movies, and why women characters in films wear makeup in bed.
You know, as a quick aside, something I wanted to say about Spike Lee last time is that one of the things that when I first saw his films that struck me as being great about him was his character names were so unique, they stick in your mind. I still think of Nola Darling or Mars Blackman as examples of certain types of characters. Those are archetypes that ring beyond. You know, a lot of times you see a film, and there may be a great character, but afterwards you don't remember their name. You're like, oh, that, you know, the blonde guy. But in Spike Lee's movies, like Nola Darling.
He copied off of August Wilson. What people don't know is that Spike Lee was a huge August Wilson fan and used to go to see August Wilson plays in New York. And his initial movies were all people who starred in August Wilson plays. He was casting them right from August Wilson. Because even when he did Joe's Barbershop, We Cut Heads.
I've heard of it, yeah.
He had gone to the Negro Ensemble Company and talked to Samuel Jackson, Wesley Snipes, and Denzel Washington and asked them would they be in his first film. And then they were all mad at him because he didn't use any of them in Joe's Barbershop, We Cut Heads. And they were like, how did he come down here, ask us all to be in this movie, and then not use any of us?
Oh, wow.
But then eventually he used all of them. And when he was doing School Days, he really didn't know what he was doing, and he had cast Lawrence Fishburne, and he admits that in a book that Lawrence Fishburne pretty much directed School Days, you know, because he didn't know what he was doing.
I want to hear more about your book. So do you focus on films made by African Americans, or is it the kind of stuff made by white people that's often really terrible too? Or
I use both because I show the difference and and how of late even white creatives are starting to realize how they need to start writing dialogue for Black actors, because there are so many Black writers, Black producers, and Black directors coming on that if they don't up their game, I mean, you get away with a green book.
Yep.
But for every green book, there's now a Judas and the Black Messiah, which had a Black director, but they still have a lot of white writers, but the dialogue is getting much better. And the productions get much better because what changed it was Black Panther. That changed how Blacks on film had to be approached.
Thanks for listening to Let's All Go to the Lobby. Next, we discuss the recovery in 2018 of a rarely discussed short film from 1898, which depicts a Black couple sharing a kiss.
The film was hidden for, I guess, like almost 120 years because it showed two Black people showing intimacy. That was not allowed in film at the time. Somebody actually just happened to find it in their basement, and he had owned it for years and didn't know it. And he uncovered it in his basement. He had just this huge film library, and somebody else was going through it and found it.
But was that filmed as any kind of a companion piece to the more famous?
I think it was a kind of meant to be a sort of a takeoff on it. The Edison Kiss was made in like, what, 1894, 95. So this is 1898, so a little bit later. It seems to be kind of like echoing it or taking it off, you know, like. Mm-hmm.
They had to do it comedically because they couldn't show serious intimacy between two black people. And so they started laughing at the end of it. But this is right after Plessy versus Ferguson. Where Separate But Equal comes in 1896. So they were still dealing with the Jim Crow laws. I mean, they were dealing at the beginning of the Jim Crow laws. I guess it was comedy, but wasn't comedy. I think the whole kiss lasts for about 10 seconds or so. It's really
maybe a little longer, but it's under a minute for sure.
Yeah.
I know that Oscar Michaud showed intimacy between black people in his movies, which were basically do-it-yourself and independently made and distributed. So somehow in black theaters, he got away with that.
Yeah, he got away with it because he did his own production, distribution.
Right, exactly. You
know, he did everything. And also, one of the criticisms towards Oscar Michaud was that it was always the light-skinned black characters who got to show the intelligence, the intimacy, and things like that.
Oh.
And but darker black characters did not get a chance to show that same range in film. But he's still somebody who we celebrate because he still got black people in film, you know, despite the fact that he more catered towards lighter-skinned black people, he still got black people in film, so he's still celebrated.
Well, certainly The Kiss was scandalous when it reached popular audiences in the U.S., in the documentary about the Lumiere brothers that's narrated by Bernard Tavernier, he points out that it was perhaps the frumpiest kiss ever depicted on film, you know, and that basically she seems to be cleaning his mustache for him.
Oh, it's so gross.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like that they're like, he's kind of like nibbling on her lip or something. Like there's something really strange going on with between them.
You know, that brings up something that I think about a lot, about how film has helped to codify how we behave. Because if you grew up in an era without film, you didn't have any idea how to kiss necessarily. You didn't have any idea how to get shot or how to, you know, get knocked down a flight of stairs. I mean, people were just flailing. But after movies, everything got codified. Like, this is how I behave when I am feeling attracted to someone. You know, this is how I behave when I get knocked down by a taxi in the middle of, you know, New York.
I don't know about those.
But... Well, I'm exaggerating a little, but you get my point, right? That it's kind of like a sort of like a, you know, monkey see, monkey do situation where people look at what they see on the screen and they think, well, that's how people do that. And
but
so
there is something to that, though, because I used to go into schools and do a lot of workshops, and I was always going into the inner city schools. And, you know, the kids would never feel as though I was hardcore enough. And, oh, you're not thug enough, you're not hardcore enough, what are you going to talk to me about? And then I started asking the kids, so how many of you have seen anybody shot to death before? And they look at me like, yo, you're crazy? I've never seen anybody shot to death before. Well, I have. And I said, guess what I didn't hear? There was no movie score. There was no hip-hop music going in the background. Guy didn't have a long speech when he was dying. They're like, what happened? He was dead. but they thought it was going to be like how it was from Boys in the Hood or Menace to Society or some of these movies. And I said, no, that's not the way it is. So we do get a lot of our how we interact with things or how we imagine different aspects of society, we get it straight from film. And when I was telling them that, they're like, oh, we didn't realize. I was like, yeah, so don't go out trying to get shot. And then I tell them later that I was a knucklehead kid and I had to go through Scared Straight at, my mother sent me through Scared Straight at Attica. And they're like, what happened? Scared me straight. I was in Attica. You know? Wow. So it was people serving triple life. Once again, it's not whatever film you saw describing what Attica looked like. It's something else. Do get so many of our ideas about life off of film.
Yeah, and seeing things depicted in slow motion. And in life, they happen too fast to register.
Oh,
so
boy.
Often.
Yeah.
There's no time to go, No.
That is a pet peeve cliche for me. The like screaming no. I can't think of any like superhero movie or like fantasy blockbuster movie but somebody doesn't scream no at some point. And it's like so overdone. I can't believe they still do it.
It's not cinema. It's the mold that grows atop the cinema jar, right? It's like you scoop out some cinema and you get a little bit of that mold with it and you just plop it down. Because, I mean, like, I think a primary example that Anna might have been referring to is in Lord of the Rings when mm-hmm. Gandalf dies in the Fellowship of the Ring. Peter Jackson takes all this sweet time for Frodo to...
No!
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 I don't know how the audiences are going to hear the episodes once they're edited, but right now, this is the first time we've met you, Anna, so welcome to the table. And I'd like to hear a lot about your book, because the premise itself is fascinating. What is your thesis? What's the message behind what you wrote about?
Thanks. The book is about looking at the ways that post-war Hollywood cinema basically took imperial aesthetic traditions from European imperial culture and adopted it and adapted it for a specifically U.S. imperial context. We're looking at the post-World War II period when the U.S. is really rising on the world stage as this new world power. It really sees itself as a new world power. And it's increasingly becoming aware of itself as like the inheritor of European imperial cultural traditions. Okay, Britain and France are no longer in charge. And now we're the one who's kind of running global affairs in this benevolent way, supposedly, right? I look at the ways that that shows up in Hollywood cinema of the period. And I focus in particular on films that are set in Europe. They're Hollywood films, but they're set and or made on location in Europe. Things like An American in Paris, a whole bunch of Audrey Hepburn films, Funny Face, Sabrina, Roman Holiday, Brigadoon, The Quiet Man, A Foreign Affair is another one. And there's a whole kind of group of them that are like in the film noir vein like that, like The Third Man would be another one. Something that I always think is really fascinating to think about that's easy to forget for Americans is that most people, most places in the world, if you watch a movie, you're watching a foreign movie. There's only the US and two other countries where that is not true. And they are India and Nigeria. And that's been true for, you know, most of film history, actually, that most people most of the time watch foreign films. And there's been a couple of other historical exceptions to that, including, well, France in the very early years, and also Japan for a lot of its history had such a really strong domestic filmmaking industry mm-hmm. that it...
Mexico had its internally funded, the government funded film industry, because they considered entertainment and diversion to be an important thing for the government to invest in for their people.
That's true in most European countries as well, and in a lot of places around the world, because there's simply no way for most local film industries to compete with Hollywood. And so if any films are going to get made locally in people's own languages, et cetera, at all, it's usually because there's a government funding.
Yeah, Australia didn't get serious about it until the 1970s with Ozploitation.
I'm fascinated by the thesis about imperial style, and I wonder if that also implies a visual style. You know, I know in the 50s, widescreen came in, and that was associated with trying to compete with television. But I'd be curious to know how the visual style of films after World War II reflected this European imperial, or formerly European imperial view.
That's kind of what the book is about, the visual culture aspects of it, and the ways that that kind of made its way into Hollywood. So my book has four main chapters. Each chapter is looking at a different aesthetic tradition in European imperial culture. So the first chapter is about the sublime, and the second one is about the ethnographic. The third one is about the picturesque, and the fourth one is about glamour. And for each of those, I trace the history of how these arose within and connected to European imperialism. And then the ways that that gets kind of like adopted into Hollywood in this post-war period.
Which would be the easiest for you to encapsulate? Which one would you like to define first?
Oh, gosh. How about glamour?
Okay, so my knee-jerk reaction is glamour is the depiction of a better life than the one you lead. The life of luxury, of privilege. Am I close in defining what glamour represents in film?
Absolutely. It's a structure of longing. That's how some scholars have defined glamour, as a kind of a structure of longing in capitalism. It's defined as an aspirational image for working class people to aspire to. That's been known for a long time, that it has all these kind of interesting classed and gendered associations. But what I think has not been discussed, that I really try to dive into in the book, is thinking about glamour as something that's about race and imperialism. So, for example, the basic building blocks of glamorous clothes and glamorous items are things like silk, cotton, fur, various gems and, you know, gold and things, minerals. These are all products of colonial exploitation on a mass scale, going back hundreds of years. The material building blocks of glamour are all items that come straight from colonialism, that are actually like, that are a big part of how colonialism got built.
And today we see it on TV with Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there are many other examples. And Tari, please.
Some of that is the product of New York, and the New York designers were influencing so much of fashion in film, mm-hmm. which affected all of us and all of our thoughts of, this is what's glamorous. You have to be wearing silk. It has to flow, mm-hmm. like it flows in the movies. You know, mm-hmm. like, you know, the gowns that women were wearing, it has to sparkle, especially in black and white. It's amazing in black and white, and you see these diamonds sparkling. It's like, how's it sparkling that much in black and white? It's not even making sense. And there was a propaganda in there. During the Great Depression, the movies became more glamorous.
The subtitle of my chapter on glamour is The Bombshell and the Princess, because there's two different modes of women's fashion. And in both of them, I'm thinking primarily about white women, actually, who were at this kind of often positioned at the top of this sort of like hierarchy of aspiration. And white women are very often wearing these jewels and furs and silks and so on that literally kind of position them and signal them as winning, right? As within this kind of like divided world where people are either rich or poor and you're either kind of winning or losing in this capitalist imperialist system, white women's bodies are literally kind of showing them as being on the winning side. Now, the two kind of archetypes I look at are Marilyn Monroe and Audrey Hepburn. So Marilyn Monroe is the bombshell, the kind of classic. It's a little bit tacky, right? A little bit over the top, excessive. And then Audrey Hepburn comes along and she changes what glamour means. So Marilyn Monroe is kind of on the tradition of what has been going on in Hollywood for two decades or more at that point. You know, this really excessive, over the top kind of glamour that, like, rich people don't actually dress that way because it's too over the top, right? Like, it's nouveau riche, right? It's like the Kardashians. Whereas Audrey Hepburn comes and really shifts that. She has this very tasteful, very kind of demure style that's very different from this like over the top diamonds thing. And so she, I think, shifts glamour and it becomes this more secure aesthetics of ownership than it had been. Marilyn Monroe, like, it's literally called the bombshell for a reason. Like, it's got this signification of like conquering the world with this like sexy woman's figure. Everyone wants it. And so everyone watches Hollywood movies and everyone purchases American stuff, right? Audrey Hepburn is all about this aesthetics of kind of secure belonging. It's more tasteful. It doesn't announce itself quite so loudly, but it seems to be, I think, really powerfully speaking to white people's desires to feel like owners.
The thing that always mystified me about the way women were portrayed in older films, as opposed to learning about women as I actually grew up, was that in films, the looks that they have are instantly attainable. A woman wakes up with full makeup and done hair. Woman in a film from your era, unless it was important to the plot for some reason, usually to make a joke, ever was shown shaving their legs. Mm-hmm. Like they apparently just walked into a closet and walked out looking like Marilyn Monroe, mm-hmm. or Audrey Hepburn.
But even later in the 70s, we still find that, because it's one of my favorite movies, but a critique I have of Lady Saints of Blues is Diana Ross is in She's in rehab. Actually, she's strung out on, before she gets to rehab, she's strung out on heroin, and her hair is still pressed. She still has curls. Mm-hmm. You know, like her hair is still, as the sisters would say, her hair was still laid. So everything got strung out, but her hair.
Yeah. You know? That's a good motto for Hollywood, actually. Everything gets strung out except your hair.
You know, and it was actually an ex-girlfriend who had to point that out to me, and I was so mad at her because I was like into this movie, and any woman that I dated had to watch Lady Sings the Blues to understand me. Mm-hmm. And she was watching it and she was like, "But why is her hair still look so nice?" I was like, "Just shut up."
That's part of it though. Part of the claim of glamour is naturalness, right? Like that, you know, that like, that you belong in the halls of power because you naturally fit within this, you know, you always look this good, right? Like,
even on Gilligan's Island.
Yeah, totally.
Ginger looks
change
like Ginger.
Change of clothes. And they were on a 3-hour tour.
Although I think the hair thing is also about continuity. I read this great article, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it was called, like, Why Do Women in TV Always Have the Same Hair? And the answer is it's always that kind of, like, slight, looks like it's been done with a curling iron, like, slightly curly, kind of bouncy look. And the reason is because you have to always have the same hair. Like, it, you know, if your hair's messier, then it looks different in every scene, and it looks different, you know, each time you cut, it's going to look different. But your hair has to, for continuity purposes, the hair has to always look the same. So it has to, like, that's why they do it.
One thing that came to mind in this discussion for me was Ingrid Bergman, because she was tired of being the glamorous movie star, and she thought the films that she was in lacked that realism that she saw in Rossellini's Rome, Open City, and then she ended up going to Italy to make films with him, and they got married, and it was a scandal in America. So it's interesting that Italian neorealism went against the grain of what you're talking about and decided to show working people, people without makeup, and the struggles of poor people and so forth. And that was a big influence on European film and a little bit, I think, on American film, the idea of shooting on location and so forth. But the mainstream Hollywood movies continued. They still projected this dominant image of. And you're right, it seems to me that most of the heroes and heroines in Hollywood film in Europe are rich, financially independent, all the stuff that they do.
Even when they're narratively not rich, they still look rich and kind of act rich. Like, I'm thinking Summertime, one of my favorite movies, actually, but in that's Katharine Hepburn. In that one, she's supposed to be this kind of secretary who's saved up just a really long time to go on this trip to Venice. And yet, I mean, she's Katharine Hepburn. Like, she, right. You know, she like comes across as a rich person. She dresses in these beautiful clothes, as always. And yeah, so it's really, I think you're absolutely right that like I think that's a really baked in part of Hollywood style. That's so baked in that it's often seen as something that's like beneath discussion. Like, it's like so obvious that it's not worth talking about, you know, but I think there's actually a lot of interest.
What I find interesting is that it's been the exact opposite for black characters, especially since the 60s. They had to kind of show where this character came from the bottom and had to rise from that place. And one of the characters that still makes the black community extremely angry, and I'm one of the only people who actually liked this role, was Halle Berry in Monster's Ball. You want to get a black woman mad? Say that you liked her role in that movie.
Huh.
And, oh man, you know, like that can be an instant blowout argument by saying that I believe that she did a great job and she deserved her Oscar. The last part, she deserved her Oscar, will probably
get you cussed
up. Yeah, I liked
that movie. I liked that film, so it surprises me that there's this feeling among a lot of black women against the movie.
Well, what's the key point of contention?
There's a very raw, it's not a love scene, it's a sex scene between she and Billy Bob Thornton. And recently, Angela Bassett was interviewed and said she was originally offered that role. And she said she turned it down because she was not going to play the role of a hooker. I'm like,
no,
but she wasn't a hooker in that movie. but that is still one of the most polarizing. It was ironic that she won for Best Actress and Denzel won for Best Actor because those are two of the most polarizing characters in the black community in film. is
Training Day.
Training Day and Monsters Ball, and they won the same year.
It also reminds me of what we were saying before, that the audience is so used to this glamorous sheen over the movies that when you do get realism, they're just like, no, I don't want to see something that looks like my life.
Yes.
I want to see something that I can escape from my life.
And there was no glamorism to Halle Berry at all in that entire movie.
Anna, I would love to hear your comments.
Well, I was just thinking your comments about realism. I mean, that's kind of where it comes from, right? Is directly in opposition to this, like, Hollywood is perceived as so glamorous, so kind of over the top. Everything looks so good all the time. Everyone lives in beautiful houses. They wear beautiful clothes. Their hair always looks good. Obviously, a lot of people want that, like, or these films wouldn't be popular. And that's a big part of their appeal. But, you know, neorealism arose in Italy, you know, precisely as a response to this, as a kind of like, we're going to show people who, you know, actual real people who in their real clothes, who live in real places. And it's not just this fantasy world. So like, and that's so much of realism, which has been this, you know, big global art movement for the last, like, what, 80 years, is that's where it comes from, is this like desire to not be Hollywood. Like, it's this pretty directly oppositional kind of thing.
People say that, and then they try to go as Hollywood as possible. well,
they do like, both.
This is not going to be Hollywood at all. And then they go to their focus groups, and they, one movie that comes to my mind is Love Jones, and Nia Long's character. They're standing outside in the rain, and they profess each other's love to each other. And while the rain is pouring down on them, the whole film was shot. It was done. And then they showed it to a focus group, and black women said, no sister stand out there in the rain getting her hair wet like that. And you need to reshoot the entire scene. And they had to reassemble the cast, go back, reshoot the scene where they walk into under a viaduct. And that's the ending of the movie. So we want realism. Right. We don't want Hollywood until we want Hollywood.
We want Hollywood, yeah. Well, interestingly, there's a class implication here, too. Like the people who want the realism are often the film snobs, right? Like, are often,
right.
Like have this sort of higher brow taste, even though it's a working class genre. Anyway, it's very confusing.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Get ourselves a treat, delicious things to eat. The popcorn can't be beat. The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars are nut candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby. Get ourselves a treat.
Let's All Go to the Lobby is a production of AZPM. The recording engineer was Leah Britton. The music in this episode was by Oceanography. Thanks to the University of Arizona School of Theater, Film, and Television. You can find all of our episodes on the Let's All Go to the Lobby page at azpm.org.
No!
No.
Support comes from Fox Tucson Theater's Picture Palace series, a diverse mix of classic films, family movie events, music and movie nights featuring local musicians paired with a themed movie, and independent Mexican film screenings by Cinema Tucson. More information is at foxtucson.com.